America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Democracy in America, in many people's estimation, is hanging by a thread, given the legal, political, and physical threats against it in the 2020 presidential election. Each of us came to realize how fragile the system is and how open to manipulation if a few bad actors are in positions to upend the wishes of the voters. Rather than buttressing voting protections, many states are going in the opposite direction and weakening the safeguards. Will the levee hold in 2024? Let's discuss today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Robert Brandon. He's the president and the CEO of a group called Fair Elections Center. And I know we've had you on before, Robert, to talk about what has gone on, certainly since the tumultuous 2020 election, and there is a lot that we need to update ourselves on. But I just want to remind our listeners who you are and what the organization is about.
So first of all, it's nice to be back. I am a longtime public interest lawyer in Washington, D.C., and I started the Fair Elections Center in 2006 as the Fair Elections Legal Network. We do work around protecting voting rights, and in terms of litigation, we work on advocacy at the state level in particular in favor of reforms of the system to make it voting more accessible and registration more accessible. And we also work against the increasing number of voter suppression laws that are being debated or passed around the country. In addition to that, we work a very large program called the Campus Vote Project, which partners with college administrators to deliver to their the basic information they need to register and vote and cast a ballot that's going to count. And that's like the largest nonpartisan effort in the country, reaching students, both students who are on residential campuses and students that are at community colleges and minority-serving institutions. And then finally, we have been involved in helping to recruit and diversify the poll workers that work in the elections, the sort of election heroes that are working and helping their neighbors. And we do that through a project called WorkElections.org, which collects information on over 5,000 jurisdictions in the country so people can find out where they live, plug in a simple address or a county or zip code, and get the information they need about how to be a poll worker, and they can actually apply directly to the jurisdiction at that point. In 2020, because of the massive fleeing of older poll workers because of the pandemic, we partnered with other organizations to launch something called Power of the Polls, which was operating on our API and with our data to reach more than 700,000 people that reached out in return to election officials to sign up to be poll workers. And we averted what could have been a very bad situation of not having anywhere near enough poll workers to run the November election.
Well, let's talk about the 2020 election and talk about the 2024 in relation to that. Just recently, a federal judge came out and said that Dr. Eastman, who was an attorney in some kind of relationship with Donald Trump, the judge said Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election. an action unprecedented in American history. Their campaign was not confined to the Ivory Tower. It was a coup in search of a legal theory. Now, I think we take it for granted, Mr. Brandon, that in fact, something that is pretty miraculous happens every 4 years, and that is that we have an election, and we assume that we can settle our differences peacefully, and that there are certain rules about the transfer of how that power can go back from one party to another. And yet we cannot take that for granted based upon what we've seen in the recent election, can we?
Well, that's right. I think we have to be really vigilant and recognize that this is an extraordinary circumstance in our, 240 years plus as a nation, where we've seen the regular transfer of power. It's the, sort of the hallmark of our democracy, attempted to be subverted not just by the sitting president at the time who lost the election, but way too many other people in positions of power. And I think we have to be really careful about that, needless to say. Obviously, in the end, what they tried to do not only was illegal, but was not successful. But it continues to be a drumbeat for too many people in the country. And it really undermines the most important part of our democracy, which is the faith we have in our elections and in electing our elected officials at all levels of government.
Well, let's go back to 2000 even, and we had the Help America's Vote Act that was meant to deal with some of the problems that we saw in Florida and throughout that particular election. If that was a warning, 2020, let's say, was a real flare. What do we have to do as we're looking forward to 2024 to deal with the problems that have accumulated over this period of time?
Well, I mean, there were so many different issues that played into not only the election, the attempt to subvert the election, but also what's going on now as a result of a minority of people in the country believing that the election wasn't legitimate and believing the lies they hear about the results of the election. So I think, first of all, we have to recognize that our system of election administration is fairly extraordinary. We have thousands and thousands of local jurisdictions and election officials who, generally speaking, have run elections for years fairly successfully. And then in the face of a pandemic and an extraordinary year, ran the largest turnout election in history, which people who studied the election will also say was the most secure election. So we had the amazing circumstance of being in a pandemic, having to change a lot of the way we cast ballots by mail, remotely, et cetera, but still wound up with being able to have an election that saw the most number of people ever cast ballots. I think we just have to give recognition to that. Now, having said that, those same election officials are being attacked, and we have to protect this office. It's very important at all levels of jurisdictions around the country, from Secretary of State down to the local clerk, and the people that help run the elections, the poll workers. So that's one thing. We obviously also saw a great deal of misinformation both leading up to the election, right after the election, and continuing in the media and in social media. And I think we have to be, there's been plenty of analysis done about the role that social media played in particular in continuing to enhance and provide a megaphone for outright lies about the election. And, I think there's got to be a real effort to kind of not let the social media platforms be used as a vehicle for misinformation and disinformation, both before elections and after.
Well, the National Task Force on Election Crisis, many people may not know that they came out with some recommendations, obviously you do, recently. They really did give a lot of credit to the mitigation efforts of local election administrators, people who really, Republicans and Democrats, held their ground against a lot of attacks that came particularly from the president himself, that social media companies learned some key lessons from 2016 and that election reporting was careful and voters were patient throughout the entire process. Having said that, there's a recognition that there are certain things that really need to be cleaned up. And one of the things that is talked about a good deal is this Electoral Count Act, the process for tabulating the electoral votes that decide who becomes president. And of course, that was best illustrated by the pressure that was put on the vice president, Mr. Pence, to change the results himself, or at least to try to throw the entire election to the House of Representatives. What's your thought about that?
It does seem like the Electoral Count Act, which was 2 centuries ago when it was enacted, does have some vagueness about some pieces of it. It wasn't at all vague, I think, for most people's minds, that the vice president didn't have the opportunity to deny certification. But there are some pieces that could be changed. The one thing I would say, and there's an effort to do that, it is not a substitute for passing federal protections of voting rights that have been held up in Congress, the John Lewis Voting Act and the Voting Rights Act. But it's something that should be addressed, just as I say, it's not a substitute for building in protections at the federal level for voting.
Well, we will talk about that, but it does seem that if there is any opportunity to have a bipartisan piece of voting legislation enacted, and we know that there were two Democrats that held up actually the acts that you're talking about, that the law's confounding language that creates this space for a narrative about a stolen election and a legal path to take it back, that has to be addressed. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think that's right. But as I mentioned, I think there's a lot of misinformation and mischaracterization of what is allowed and not allowed under the Electoral Count Act. But there's certainly some vagueness that could be addressed. And again, the law itself now, as we're learning after the fact, is not enough to give people who had crazy ideas about just ignoring the will of the people in the states in terms of the elections to just decide to overturn an election and the certification that Congress has to provide.
Well, what did we leave unsaid that should be said more clearly when we were trying to deal with a controversial election back in 1876, which led to this Electoral Count Act?
Well, I think the whole process can be modernized and updated, obviously, because this is a long time since then and things have changed. But we want to, we want to just clarify that the system we have requires certification of elections at the state level, and really the opportunity for the Congress is to simply acknowledge the certifications. I think where we get into a gray area is that there's sort of debate and questions, obviously, but many of those have been lacked really a legal foundation, and they were just looking as a subterfuge for really just trying to ignore the will of the people and the election and keep Donald Trump in office.
Let me talk about another legal reform, amending the Presidential Transition Act. Now, what does that involve?
That one of the problems that occurred this time was there is a single agency that decides when the transition and how the transition operates. That's the General Services Administration. It is run by a presidential appointee always. And in the case of the 2020 election, that the head of the GSA, under a lot of pressure apparently, didn't trigger the transition for at least 2 weeks, as I recall. So number one, it's a practical matter. It really hurts the actual work of trying to keep the government going in a systematic way and sharing information from one administration to another. But also it fed some of this confusion and conspiracy about, oh, well, we're really not sure about the election and we should wait on the transition. It was just another button to push that Donald Trump tried to push all over the place.
Well, this National Task Force on Election Crisis Do you think that they've done a good job? Basically, it was a bipartisan group of experts, lawyers, voting advocates. And I'm wondering, well, and I'll get into some additional recommendations that they've made, but is anybody listening to them?
Well, I don't think it's gotten a great deal of coverage. You know, there are people that sort of study elections and that administer elections and some who legislate around elections who are going to look at that, just like after the commission, the bipartisan commission that President Obama put in place, made recommendations, many of which are similar to what the task force has made here, but there's more here as well that's a little more in detail about legal changes as well as administrative changes. And you have a dynamic in this task force report that talks about the role of media, social media, that was not really something that the Obama Presidential Commission on Election Administration addressed.
Robert Brandon is with us, the president and the CEO of the Fair Election Center. And you're absolutely right. I mean, they dealt with a whole range of things. They also talk about a lot of the things that are being pushed back state by state today, things that I know you're very concerned about, options like vote by mail, early voting, better control of disinformation on social media. All of that is addressed in their report, giving a little more tightness to some of the rules in states. So, I mean, what do you think is the most important of the things that they have put forward that Congress, I would assume, is the group that has to address some of these? And what do you think the likelihood is that any of this can be put into effect either by 2022, that election in November, or 2024?
Well, I think we can't expect a lot out of Congress as long as we have the filibuster in place in terms of addressing some of these issues. As you mentioned, there's maybe an effort, a bipartisan effort, to clarify the Electoral Count Act. That's not sufficient, and there will be, you know, you could do something about the Presidential Transition Act as well, that really was a minor player in some ways of what we really were facing. I do think the things that we need to worry about, mostly, particularly if there isn't going to be some progress at the federal level, have to be dealt with at the state level. But we still need to push a federal minimum standard about voting so that we don't have a continuation of these efforts to undermine basic operations about voting that make it harder and harder for people to cast their ballot. I mean, a good example is just recently in Texas, where you had tens of thousands of ballots that were thrown out. The very same ballots would have been counted before the legislature made a change that required an absolute match on an absentee ballot to the identification number that somebody used in registration before, and for the first time required some additional information on the outside of an envelope, which many people forget to do, and then usually they get a chance to cure that deficiency. The problem is that this was new to many people. So you had people like using absentee ballots, seniors that can do it as a matter of course in Texas, who had always done that in one way, and now they were told to do it differently. And if they made a mistake, they were told they had to literally come in person. Well, the whole reason you had an absentee ballot for many seniors is they have trouble with the mobility of getting down to a polling place. So that's just one example, but we need to do a lot in election administration to continue to provide resources, and I was glad to see that the president just put into his budget a substantial investment in provided for local election officials to maintain adequate resources to run an election. And, you know, that's really important. It's also important to continue to reinforce the laws that are in place to protect people from being harassed about voting, or harassed for that matter about running the elections. We've had, you know, too many election officials either attacked physically or verbally, or families threatened. It's pretty awful. And, you know, that we need to do something seriously about that. You know, I would also say one of the things that the recommendations of the task force were to eliminate a situation where you have a Secretary of State running an election and running for office at the same time. to eliminate those conflicts of interest. And then I would say, you know, a big part of the issue in 2020 was, given the huge volume of mail-in ballots or absentee ballots, and too many states have a requirement that they can't look and pre-canvas or pre-count those ballots that come in until after Election Day. So you had some states that waited 3, 4, 5, 6 days before they had a decent count on what the results were. And in like places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, that was a big deal in terms of holding up and raising concerns about the election. Many states are able to start counting the ballots when, in advance when they get them. They're secure. They're secure just like as they are after Election Day. And that should be changed as well.
The New York Times, in a very compelling editorial back a few months, wrote January 6th was a warning. Will lawmakers do anything to protect the 2024 election? In it, they posed the question, what if a state submits two conflicting slates of electors? And what if the two houses of Congress disagree over which slate is valid? And they talked about that as being a different sort of problem, but we almost had that because President Trump was trying to send a different slate of electors in these more hotly contested states. What do you think of that? I mean, what it would do to address that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I understand why there's concern, but that's kind of I don't think that's a circumstance. So when you say that Trump tried to, had alternative electors, those were completely illegal. They just, a state has a system in place where they count the ballots, they certify a winner, and then the people that were electors of that winner are listed as the electors for the Electoral College. And the fact that Trump and some of his, supporters decided to just make up their own list, send it to the archives and a number of other places and said, we're the electors, doesn't change the fact that that was an illegal process. And maybe some of them will get in trouble for that. I don't know, but I'm less concerned about that than many of the other obstacles that are going to be in the way, frankly. I think we have to plan for the worst, but we also have to continue to move to make sure this system allows everybody to vote. I think that's going to be ultimately the answer to many of these problems. To have more and more people making their voice heard makes it harder and harder to ignore that.
I do want to get back to that and what's going on state by state and get your view of that. But let me ask you this. Under the Constitution, state legislatures do have the authority to appoint electors however they choose. Now, I think that'll surprise a lot of the people listening to this podcast. But if they decide, which they all have, that they'll leave it up to the voters and then the electors will reflect what the voters in their state decided. But in certain cases, we had legislatures that their leaders were meeting with Donald Trump to try to figure out a way to kind of reverse the way that they would do it and take back that responsibility unto themselves. Now, I mean, that seems odd. It really does to most of us who are rational. However, I'm reading about the U.S. Supreme Court, and four members of the U.S. Supreme Court have really weighed in, at least in some of their writings, about an independent legislature theory of the case as to what they can and cannot do within state legislatures to set forward electors to go to the Congress for ratification.
I don't want to give this quote theory too much credence. I mean, it's been written about a little bit tangentially and speculated, but it's really a mischaracterization of the way the Constitution gives states the authority over elections. That what the Constitution says is that the state legislatures can set the manner of elections. So that would mean things like they could put together a runoff process. They could have ranked choice voting. They could do things like that. But the courts, this theory is that if the legislature does something that the state court deems unconstitutional under state law, somehow it's not up to the state courts to decide, that the federal courts are going to swoop in and say, well, this is under the Constitution something that the federal courts, it would make every dispute around election law and election administration in every state a federal case. It would so dramatically overturn history and decades of precedent that I don't believe this will ever be adopted, even though some of the extreme members of the court have speculated about this. I think in the end, the independent state legislature theory is a pretty thin theory, and I don't think it's something are going to see.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you, before we get back to state by state, Alan Hirsch, who wrote a book called A Short History of Presidential Election Crisis, talked to me maybe about a year and a half ago, before all of this, about how fragile he thought the process was, and that we had avoided historically some really challenging crises. 1876, we mentioned that one, but there were others. And he said that the solution to a disputed presidential election, and we saw that in 2000, and it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the basis of that decision, 5-4, has meant that the court ever since has had about a 40% approval rating. So they have been deemed more partisan, I think, than ever in modern history. But he said the solution to a disputed presidential election is a permanent nonpartisan commission. Commission could be created by statute, but a constitutional amendment would be required to make the January 20 inauguration flexible. That is to allow the commission to postpone it under certain conditions. I mean, how inflexible does that January 20 date make it?
I really haven't thought about that aspect, what you're talking about, an independent commission. I really am not sure how I feel about that. Sorry, the January 20th date is a real date. So I really don't know what to say about that, to tell you the truth.
Okay, that's fine. It's just another idea. Just because there is some vagueness in certain of the processes that we now undertake, and we saw where a candidate who is also the sitting president tried to drive a Mack truck through that vagueness. Let me just ask you this. When we look at what's going on state by state, you mentioned Texas. We've also heard about many other states that are using Texas and some of the others, Georgia, Florida, as examples of the type of legislation that they want to enact. We know that the Voting Rights Act itself needs to be buttressed because a major provision of that was gutted by the Supreme Court. Where are we in that regard? I mean, without this federal legislation, where do things stand as you see it?
Yeah, I think ultimately the federal protections that would come with a federal Voting Rights Act enhancement, restructuring to back to what it was, and these other pieces of legislation that have been put forward and that are being blocked in the Senate by a filibuster, are extremely important to guarantee all Americans the right to vote at a federal minimum. Various ways to do that. What is happening now is state legislatures using the excuse of the big lie, there was fraud in the last election, which, you know, every instance of looking carefully at it, which was done a lot by the courts and by others, show there was no substantial fraud at all. And in the most successful turnout election in history. But using that as an excuse, legislatures trying to make sure that certain people don't vote, particularly the ones that they think aren't going to vote for them if they're in the majority. And that's often the communities that have traditionally faced barriers to voting, communities of color, immigrant communities, young people, et cetera. So what we've seen is, you know, just everything you can imagine. Turnout was huge because people had more access to mail balloting or absentee voting for the first time. What do you do? Let's get rid of that. Let's cut it back. Early voting was a big option for people and has been in 35 or so states. Let's cut that back. Drop boxes were very successful, particularly as people worry more and more about the delivery of the mail. If we're going to have drop boxes, let's make them only available at the precinct, where the precincts would be, inside the building. That sort of defeats the whole purpose of drop boxes. And you can just go down the list, toughening, making it, having more narrowly drafted ID requirements. Arizona, the legislature, and it's waiting to see whether the governor is going to pass this, just passed a new law. They had some pretty bad ones from last year. A new law that would require a new proof of citizenship top of the one you already are required to produce when you register in Arizona. Now you have to have one at the polls or when you cast an absentee ballot. There's, just endless numbers of ways to make it harder when we all know that the real challenge here is to make it so that more people can vote. We have a terrible turnout number in this country compared to most democracies around the world, and yet we try to hold ourselves up as an example of democracy. And yet we continue to throw barriers in the way of ordinary citizens in their effort to cast a ballot and make their voice heard.
In closing, let me ask you, even though the attempts to overturn the election were ultimately unsuccessful, the report that we've been referring to, the National Task Force on Election Crisis, they note, let me quote them, likely caused lasting damage, these unsuccessful attempts, not only to the acceptance of the 2020 election outcome, but to the perceived legitimacy and long-term stability of American institutions and our system of government. And the institutions may not hold next time. How concerned are you about that?
I'm always an optimist. While there's concern, I think that over time, first of all, I think we're going to see, I'm interested to see the January 6th hearings committee come out and talk about everything that went on that led to this insurrection at the Capitol and who all was involved. And I think it will begin to discredit a lot of these people that hold out these lies and try to promote them. So I think by the, as each year goes by, we're going to see fewer and fewer people buying into the big lie that from 2020 and beginning to look more critically at the people that have tried to perpetuate that and at the same time have tried to reduce access to the poll. My issue is always we need to get more people voting. The more we get people making their voice heard, the less likely we're going to see a successful effort to undermine that in the end. And that's true at all levels of government. That's the role, that's what we do in our organization, and we're particularly focused on young people through our Campus Vote Project. We worked and partnered with campuses around the country where over 3.5 million students were enrolled. Should say, on those campuses, to educate them about the importance of making their voice heard and make them lifetime voters from an early age. And the young people really made the difference in this last election. Their turnout was at record high numbers compared to history. And we need to continue to work on that, as well as the other constituencies that have seen barrier after barrier attempted to be thrown in the way.
Well, fairelectioncenter.org, they've got a great new report out, Democracy's Future, that discusses ways to counter the trend to block youth voting. And you've also got HBCU Insights Brief from your Legacy Initiative, a collection of thoughts and concerns from administrators, faculty, and students on barriers to voting that young African Americans continue to face. So really important material that you're developing on behalf of the young voters in America. And Robert Brandon, I want to thank you once again, our second time having the privilege of talking to you about these really important issues. Again, fairelectionscenter.org. Thanks again for being with us on America Trends.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to talk to you.